welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Raccoons and skunks and rats and pigeons and parrots and deer. Zooburbia is what Ty Moses calls the extraordinary, unruly, half-wild realm where human and animal lives overlap. She writes, as our cities grow and sprawl to accommodate burgeoning populations of humans, wild animals that once lived in woods and canyons and meadows are making their homes across the street from us or even in our backyards. Modern cities are intricate ecosystems teeming with a multitude of species that straddle the line between wild and not so wild. So today on Your Call, that's what we're going to devote the hour to, a conversation about the animals all around us and how we interact or ignore them. Ty Moses has been a journalist for more than two decades. She's edited alternative news weeklies in Monterey, Santa Cruz, and Silicon Valley. And she's former senior editor of Alternet, an online progressive news magazine. And she's the author of this new book that I'm holding in my hands here, Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. Welcome, Ty.
Thank you, Holly. It's wonderful to be here.
So each chapter is a different story about a different animal and a different animal interaction. But you kind of say, so a lot of this is a little depressing in terms of, you know, how endangered animals are around us and how they're being pushed out. But you also say that we're seeing a shift in the way that people are viewing nature. I think you write, like, for 250 years of our urban planning, our MO, so to speak, has been about conquering nature. But now maybe we're seeing a shift. Can you talk about what you're seeing?
Sure. Yeah, I definitely have seen an evolution in thinking about nature, and especially nature that is not just foreign and distant and exotic, but what's local and ordinary and right in front of us. I think people are starting to become more aware of the animals around them that are just right in their own backyards, that are making their homes very near our homes. And these are the animals like deer, raccoons, squirrels, skunks, opossums, and even not so wild animals like feral cats that live at the fringes of our neighborhoods. There's a trend toward what's called wildlife gardening, which is a way of recognizing that our gardens and the yards around our homes are not just our property, they are also the homes of other animals. And so people are planting native plants that feed animals. They're providing water for birds. They are making sure there are places for animals to raise their young and have shelter.
And you write about that very poignantly in this book about how, you know, you were trying to have a vegetable garden when you first moved to your house in Oakland, and you were kind of fighting nature, fighting the slugs and the snails and the, you know, the pests, right? Which is often.
Yes.
And then you kind of had this big mind shift. Tell us about that.
I was an utter failure as a vegetable gardener, and that is partly where this book came from. When I first moved to my house, which is at the foot of the foothills in Oakland, about 5 miles from downtown, I was so excited to have a house and a large flat space in the back where I could finally raise chickens and grow vegetables. And so I immediately put in a huge garden with two raised beds, and I got three chickens and a chicken coop. And before long, I was essentially doing battle on a daily or even hourly basis with all the other animals that already lived in my backyard, the native wildlife, that wanted to eat what I was growing, of course. And essentially, I was making salad for deer. And this went on for a couple of months until I finally had an epiphany where I realized that I wasn't having any fun, and I was basically living in an urban wildlife corridor where animals had lived for centuries, and they had no other place to get their food, where I could just go to Whole Foods and get a wonderful salad. So I took out my raised beds, and I rehomed my chickens, and I started...
Rehomed the chickens is finding them an adopted...
I found them a wonderful new home in Woodside, yes, where they live to this day, free-ranging and having a great life, yeah. Free of raccoons who are trying to eat them. So instead of growing vegetables, I planted more native plants in my backyard that provided natural food for animals, berries and seeds. And while there already were a lot of native animals in my backyard, I started to see many more species and more birds, especially.
And butterflies, you talk about the butterflies
that
you were able to
attract. Butterflies, yeah, lots and lots of bees, pollinators essentially, winged pollinators that are so important for us. So planting these native plants was a way of welcoming and inviting these animals, these birds and pollinators, back into the habitat that already belonged to them.
And this is kind of a newish movement called wildlife gardening. So talk to us a little bit how it works.
I think there are a lot of names for it. It's also called birdscaping, ecoscaping, and there are many, many initiatives around the country that are helping homeowners and renters do this. And I think the National Wildlife Federation was one of the first pioneers. Probably about 35 years ago, they began their wildlife habitat program, where they would basically certify your backyard or even your community garden as a certified wildlife habitat if it met four criteria. It has to provide food, water, cover, and a place for animals to raise their young. And so this has been going on for a few decades, but I think it's really caught on now, and several other groups like Audubon and the Humane Society have pitched in, and they have ways to help people do this. And it's really simple. You can do it on a grand scale with your whole garden, or you can just on your apartment terrace put out a little bird bath and a couple of containers of plants. But either way, you're helping enormously, because collectively all this patchwork of habitat adds up to a tremendous amount of land that really does benefit birds and bees and butterflies and animals.
And it's mutually beneficial for humans as well.
Sure.
We
need these pollinators. We absolutely need them. I think one out of every three bites of food that we eat is pollinated by a bird or a bee or a butterfly or another pollinator. And, when we spray chemicals with abandon that kill insects, we are essentially killing ourselves. We're killing pollinators. And so we really can't afford to do that anymore.
And my guest is Ty Moses. She's the author of Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And we're talking about the importance of protecting animals in an urban area and in suburbia as well. More than 80% of Americans live in cities or suburbs, which means many of us are cut off from nature in our daily lives. But Moses says it doesn't have to be that way. Urban animals are all around us. So I'm going to invite our listeners to join our conversation. Our number is 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Call and tell us about the interactions that you've had with wildlife, or if you've ever saved an injured animal, or if you battle wildlife, raccoons or gophers or slugs and snails. Let us know about that as well. 866-798-TALK. Talk. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What relationships do you have with the animals in your neighborhood? You can share it with us. My guest again is Ty Moses, and her book is Zooburbia. And we're also joined by Lila Travis, who is with Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue. Welcome, Lila.
Thank you for having me.
And so in the book, Ty tells the story of how you two met, and that was because you found this tiny baby raccoon.
Yes, I went out one morning and I found a little baby raccoon huddled against the back of my house. It was broad daylight. Raccoons are nocturnal. You don't generally see them out in the daylight. And you rarely, if ever, see a baby raccoon on its own. They are always with their siblings and their mother. So to see this little raccoon on its own, clearly something was wrong. She wasn't responsive. She was gripping her head with her hands like she had a horrible headache. And so I called Lila, who is the director of Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue, and she said that she would meet me right away and take the raccoon. And so we drove to meet in the parking lot of Urban Ore, I think it was. Right, Lila?
Right.
In Berkeley. And I put the little raccoon in a box, and I met her there in the parking lot. And handed over the patient, and she took the raccoon back and said she'd call me in a few hours and let me know what the result was.
Yeah. And the result ultimately was that this baby raccoon, had distemper, and its mother had died and left it there.
Yeah. It was unfortunately, the baby was in a lot of distress, and that's why she was gripping her head. And unfortunately, we weren't able to do anything in that situation except make the baby comfortable and help her to not suffer anymore.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the work that you do, Lila, with your Urban Wildlife Rescue. You said, to, as we were preparing to do this show, you said, well, you know, not everybody stops when there's an animal that's been hurt, you know, maybe a deer that's got hit by a car or whatever, or in this case, the raccoon. But talk about the work that you were doing at that time.
Well, what Ty was saying about the new movement of gardening for wildlife and wildlife awareness, wildlife rehabilitation, is rehabilitating orphaned and injured wildlife in our urban city centers. Because most people don't realize or they're not aware of the raccoons and the deer and the squirrels in our midst, as Ty has been saying. And wildlife rehabilitation, what we do is we try to help them when they're injured or orphaned because of cars or dogs or disease. So that's what wildlife rehabilitation is. And our organization is a wildlife rehab center. So we rehabilitate orphaned wildlife and educate people on what to do when they've found wildlife in trouble.
And so. You were in Oakland. You had a center there, but you ended up getting evicted through the Ellis Act in 2011, right?
Right.
What happened?
Well, our organization was founded in 2001, and we had an amazing facility. It was a third of an acre. We invested through the help of many organizations, including Rebuilding Together, over $100,000 in property improvements to make the hillside property usable for our wildlife center. We had a 30-year lease. And in 2010, the owner of the property took the property off the rental market, which is under the Ellis Act. And we tried to fight it for a year, but it was pretty devastating, and we ended up losing our facility.
And so now the way that you operate is that you mainly give people advice and you go to their homes to help them figure out how to...
Well, we're an all-volunteer. We've always been an all-volunteer grassroots organization. And what we do now is we essentially, our facility is the backyards of our volunteers. My backyard here in San Francisco, and the backyards of our foster care volunteers in the East Bay.
Mm-hmm. Or people like Ty, for example. So you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. That's Lila Travis. She is with Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue. I'm also joined by Ty Moses, who's the author of the new book, Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. And I'd like to get to a couple of callers. Let's go to Rishi in Berkeley. Hi, Rishi. Welcome to Your Call.
Hey, thank you very much. So I had a quick question. You know, I was renting a few years ago in Boston, and at the time I was looking at apartments, and someone introduced me to the idea of a term, varmint-friendly, and I was like, oh, what
varmint-friendly?
Yeah, that was the phrase, and okay. I was confused. I didn't know what that meant. And they said, well, basically what apartments do is they'll take the kind of wooden planks that block off the crawl space underneath the home, and they'll remove them so that, you know, raccoons, possums, skunks can get in there and raise their families there. And so it was kind of an interesting thing, and I'd never even thought about that. And just to tie up my question then, you know, with bees, we have these movements where people can, you know, go to the city and maybe get a beehive, you know, in their home. Is there any sort of program that allows your apartment or home to become more varmint-friendly in some way? Would someone come out and kind of walk you through simple steps that you could take?
To become more varmint-friendly. All right, well, thank you. Lila seems to be nodding her head here.
I actually find this amazing because I get so many calls on our wildlife hotline from people all over who want to prevent animals from getting in the crawl spaces because they can get into the wiring or get into the fiberglass and damage the property. So what I highly encourage people to do is to make their garden wildlife friendly by not cutting back all of those blackberry brambles that perhaps they're tempted to do, and to not over garden because it removes cover for wildlife. So that's really interesting. I've never heard the term varmint friendly.
Yes, I think that a better way to make your home varmint friendly would be to make sure you have completely excluded animals from your human home, and as Lila said, make the garden area more welcoming to them by providing food and leaving brush piles or downed trees that they can nest in and find cavities. Those are animals' natural homes. If we invite them to live in our homes, we're asking for trouble because they won't want to leave.
And that's often a problem that people have, is that they have unwanted varmints. Let's go to some more calls. Let's go to Sue in El Cerrito. Hi, Sue. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I want to speak up for skunks.
All right. Well, that's good. I think that they get a bad rap.
Yeah, people are. Yes, exactly. People get really afraid of skunks, and I have them come in my kitchen door, kitchen cat door, sometimes, and they are really, they're shy, they're almost polite. They, if you make a noise, they go back out, and people have been, don't they stink up your house? Never. I've been here 27 years, and it's only times I've had it happen once when my neighbor's dog went and chewed on one.
Oh, dear.
And then the dog, tomato juice doesn't work, by the way.
All right, we've got both Ty and Lila want to respond to you. So stay on the line, Sue. So skunks.
Well, I think, first of all, you're right, absolutely right, that skunks are shy animals, and they tend to be quite nearsighted, but they don't want to just spray you for no reason. That's their defense. But the point about the dog is that I think it's incumbent upon us to protect wildlife from our pets. And as much as we may love our dogs and cats, they are a tremendous danger to skunks and all kinds of other animals. And many of the animals that come into Lila's group, for example, are there because they've been injured by a dog or a cat.
And that's a very good point. I want to reinforce that skunks can only really see about 12 inches in front of them. So they're extremely nearsighted.
And go ahead.
Come in.
I'm sorry. So we missed that because you weren't. The volume was down.
The skunks come in and they smell all around. So now I understand why instead of see.
Yeah.
I had a mother skunk one time. Suddenly, I came into my kitchen and I saw four baby skunks and a mother skunk eating my cat food. And I paused and the mother skunk looked at me and. She could tell I was just melting, looking at the babies. And I just stood back, and she just told the kids, keep eating, you know.
Wow. Well, thank you so much.
They were under my storage space.
Thank you so much for calling, Sue. Go ahead, Lila.
I wanted to just mention that several years ago, the television show Mythbusters actually did a show dedicated to discovering which treatment for skunk spray actually worked, because when skunk spray, it's actually a chemical reaction that makes that horrible smell. And as we've known at our wildlife center for and all wildlife centers know, you can really only neutralize the chemical reaction by using a combination of detergent, peroxide, and baking soda. And Mythbusters actually presented that to the general public in a very interesting way. So
the tomato juice is not the way to go.
Tomato juice does not work.
Sue brought up skunks. What other animals, urban animals, do you think are the most maligned or misunderstood?
Oh, definitely that would have to be the raccoon. I get so many complaints about raccoons. People are afraid of them. They are revolted by them. They're intimidated by them. And they certainly are probably one of the most intelligent animals among us. I think their intelligence is rated on a par with primates. and they are incredible problem solvers. They can open a mason jar. They can open locks and latches. They can get into your house. They can probably make a sandwich with peanut butter and jelly from your fridge.
And all of this might be why people are upset with them.
Yes, and also raccoons and dogs, when they do tangle, dogs can get injured very badly, although dogs can also injure raccoons very badly. And you want to make sure to keep raccoons and dogs apart at all times.
Anything to add to that?
Well, raccoons are very highly intelligent, and that's what gets them into trouble in our human environment. And they have a thousand extra nerve endings in their hands, and they can practically see by touch. I mean, it's just wonderful to watch a raccoon that gets into water.
But let's say I'm somebody who really just, okay, I don't want the raccoon in my house or my yard. What's your advice to me then?
Keep your pet doors closed at night, locked from the inside.
So that's the main thing.
Don't leave pet food out because it will attract the animals to your home.
Yeah, go ahead. Ty.
Yeah, I just want to add that definitely sealing up your attic and basement and under the deck is the best way to prevent having conflicts with raccoons. But before you do that, you want to make sure there are no baby raccoons in your attic, because a desperate mother raccoon will stop at nothing to get reunited with her babies, just like any mother would. So the other thing is, if you have raccoons nesting in your attic, wait 8 or 10 weeks until the babies are old enough to go out with their mother and start foraging. That's about the amount of time that raccoons are denning, and after that they will leave your attic on their own, and then you can seal it back up and make sure they never come back.
Well, speaking of kind of misunderstood and maligned urban wildlife, what about the pigeon?
The pigeon, one of my favorite animals.
But not the favorite of many people.
No, that's true. Pigeons are probably one of the most despised animals in the animal kingdom, which is really a shame because they're beautiful birds, they're intelligent, they're incredible navigators and flyers, they're devoted parents to their young. And I think one of the reasons they're so hated is because they're so ubiquitous. There's so many of them, they're all over. But the reason they're all over is because of humans. Wherever there are people, there are pigeons. They come where our garbage is. So we happen to have a lot of garbage, and that is the reason why pigeons are so popular and so ubiquitous.
And with the drought, are animals in more danger now? How are they being affected by this drought?
I think a lot of regional little water sources like creeks and streams are drying up, and that's why animals are perhaps coming closer to homes looking for water sources. And that's why it's even more important that we keep those bird baths topped off, because your bird bath might be the only source of water for birds in the neighborhood.
And so if you had just 30 seconds to give a couple of recommendations to people living to make their yards or their balcony in the city more friendly to wildlife, what would you say?
Well, one thing that Lila touched upon a little earlier was not tidying everything up so much. Let things get a little messy in your yard. Don't cut those flowers. Don't deadhead your flowers, because birds eat the seed heads. So leave a little brush lying on the ground for lizards to find a home in, and just try not to be so much of a perfectionist, and you'll find that animals have more places to find homes.
And if you find that your green thumb is not all that green, you can do what you did, which is turn your vegetable garden into this wildlife refuge, right?
Right.
That's Ty Moses. Did you have something you wanted to add, Lila?
I just wanted to add that don't forget to enjoy watching the wildlife that you've invited to your yard.
All right. That is Lila Travis. She is with Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue. Ty Moses is a former senior editor of Alternet, and she's the author of the new book, Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. And that's what we're talking about on Your Call. If you want to join our conversation, we're at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. Let us know about your tales of urban wildlife. 866-798-8255, or send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Your Call on KALW San Francisco to join in today's conversation. The number is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say, and at noon today, Backstory here on KALW San Francisco.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about wildlife in urban areas and why we should protect nature in our cities. This is Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Tomorrow we'll ask, is tipping bad for workers? On Wednesday, the question will be, is coding the new literacy? And today, what's the importance of protecting animals in an urban area? We're talking with Ty Moses, who's the author of Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. More than 80% of Americans live in cities or suburbs, which means many of us are cut off from nature in our daily life, except we're not if we pay attention. Wildlife is all around us. And so how are you connecting with wildlife in your backyard? We're also joined by Lila Travis, who's with Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue. And let's get straight to more calls. Well, there's a lot of people that want to join us. Let's go to hear from Kay in Oakland. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I've been cohabitating with possums, raccoons, outdoor cats, and indoor outdoor cats in the flatlands of Oakland for more than 30 years. And all I do is I leave water out. I live near a creek. And even in the best of years, creeks go dry. And I have seen amazing things. The raccoons, the possums, the cats all get along very well. I saw a raccoon actually walk over an old cat to get to water, and the old cat just sat there and let the raccoon walk over him while he was sleeping. I've seen raccoons and cats both stop when the possums show up because the possums don't have very good eyesight, and the cats and the raccoons somehow know that. They don't want to scare the possums, and they just kind of play that freeze game that we used to play as kids, and the possums walk through and drink their water and leave. So it really hurts me when I hear people being afraid of raccoons, because there's nothing to be afraid of. As a matter of fact, for leaving water out for them, raccoons have done things like brought me little presents, you know, like marbles and little pieces of toys and so on. So they're as smart as we are, and all you have to do is be kind.
Well, thanks for that, Kay. That's remarkable to hear and really inspiring. I'll admit to being afraid of raccoons.
So can you tell us why?
Because they look like little bandits, and when I lived in the city in San Francisco, you know, they would come to your door, and they're pretty huge and intimidating. They frighten me. Yes, I admit it.
They can be frightening, but as Kay was saying, one of the benefits of welcoming animals is seeing how marvelously they all can coexist. Raccoons and cats, yes, and opossums and skunks. I've also seen them eating or drinking side by side, and they're all very, very peaceful. I think that animals in general are peaceful unless they feel threatened in some way. And most of the human-raccoon conflicts come about usually because there's a dog entering the mix, and maybe the dog is threatening the raccoon's baby, in which case the raccoon will absolutely defend her child, or the raccoon feels cornered in some way. I tell a story in Zooburbia about how I was walking my dog on a leash, and we came to the top of a stairway, and this was at night. There was no lighting. and there was a raccoon there at the top of the stairs.
Oh, yes.
And I couldn't see the raccoon, but my dog did, and my dog lunged at the raccoon, who then tried to squeeze past us down the stairs. The dog lunged after the raccoon, pulling me down the stairs because I was attached by the leash. All three of us fell down the stairs and landed in a pile at the bottom. And I was on top of the raccoon who broke my fall, and she was, or he was, struggling to escape and tried to bite me, but really just wanted to get away. And it did get away. It ran away into the night, and I limped back into the house with a renewed respect for raccoons after that, and a vow to be even more careful with my dog in the future.
That's Tai Moses. She's the author of Zooberbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. Let's go to Valerie in Menlo Park. Hi, Valerie. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I'm really interested in Tai Moses' book, Zooberbia, and I'm wondering if she could talk about the... Sorry, there's this time delay. I'm wondering if she could talk about her interest in combining kind of spiritual philosophy with her interest in raising consciousness about animals and living with nature.
Sure. excuse me. Thank you, Valerie. You know, that was kind of a side effect of the book that came about simply because of spending time observing animals. I didn't set out to follow any particular mindfulness practice, but I found that simply welcoming animals to my yard and doing the wildlife gardening and spending time quietly observing animals gave me such a deep sense of belonging, which I think is what people are really after when they engage in any kind of spiritual practice. They want to feel like they belong. They want to feel like they're part of the earth. They want to feel that connection to themselves. And I always tell people that people who are struggling with depression or anxiety, there is no better pharmaceutical cure than to go out in your yard and just sit there and watch birds and watch animals and plant a native plant that will provide seeds or berries for those animals and feel like you are actually making a contribution to the web of life.
And in the book, Tai writes, observing these wild creatures has helped me to cultivate the habit of mindful attention. It's kind of one of the ways that you meditate, is watching the butterflies or the bees or the birds.
It's the only way I meditate.
Yeah, this is a meditation I can get behind. Let's go to Leah in Berkeley. Hi, welcome to your call.
Yes, I have two birds that are nesting in an overgrown plant and right near my front door. I just discovered that they were there because every time I open the front door, they fly out of the plant. Now, if I move the plant a little further down in the yard, will they find the nest again?
What do you think?
I don't want to scare them every time I open the front door.
Right. It's possible that they'll abandon the nest as not working. Have you already seen eggs?
No, the plant is very overgrown. It was a plant that I was planning to cut back, but I'm not going to touch it now that I've seen them flying out. In fact, one day they got so frightened that one of them flew into the apartment.
Oh, dear.
Until I got him her outside, I was so worried that she'd have a heart attack because she was pounding her little beak against the glass in my windows. I finally opened up all the windows and was able to shoo the bird out. But okay, I won't move the plant then.
Well, try a barrier of some kind.
No, there's nothing I can do. It's in a plant stand. There's really nothing I can, make a barrier with. But one other question. I don't have bird seed. What can I leave for my kitchen cupboard outside for them to eat? I have all kinds of, poppy seeds, coriander seeds. Or celery seeds. Could I leave any of those out?
Well, the impulse to make an offering to the birds is really, really kind, but they know what type of food they can actually eat. So we should leave it up to the birds to find their own food, because they wouldn't be nesting in your plant if they didn't feel that there was food abundantly nearby.
So don't put out food. What about the bird feeders, the hummingbird feeders, all of that? What's your advice on those?
Sure. I think bird feeders are a wonderful supplement to the native plants that birds find their food from around our homes.
Lila?
I want to add that I'm not saying don't feed the birds, because in a lot of situations, we don't have the opportunity to get up and close you know, up close and personal with wildlife. And often the only way that we're really going to be able to do that is if we have a bird feeder out and catch a glimpse of a squirrel trying to get at the sunflower seeds in the feeder or something like that. And if we don't get up and close and personal with wildlife, if we don't have that observing interaction, how are we going to love them? And if we don't love them, how are we going to make an effort to save them? We have to care. And if you never see something, it's a lot harder to care about it. So within reason, don't put like 50 pounds of bird seed out every day and make the animals dependent upon you. But it's okay to put out a bird feeder.
Now, what about feral cats? I know lots of people, including those of us at the station who feed a bunch of feral cats right around the corner, that are the sole source probably or mostly for feral cats. Mm-hmm. What about that? What's your advice on that?
Feral cats are a problem that we have created. They're not a natural part of the ecosystem. That said, they have become part of the urban ecosystem, just like native wildlife. And so many cats revert to their wild instincts when they're in the wild. And I think feeding feral cats is absolutely great as long as you're also trapping and having them sterilized so they don't breed and produce more kittens who will then starve or get hit by cars or have the difficult life that a feral cat has. This process is called trap, neuter, and return. It goes by the acronym TNR. And it's really the most humane way to control the population of feral cats. I also feed feral cats where I live in Oakland, and people dump them because there's a public school campus nearby, and for some reason people think that that's a good place to just dump unwanted cats. And so I feed the cats that have been sterilized, and a neighbor of mine does TNR, and in this way we try to control the population. But feral cats also do have an effect upon bird populations, and I know there's been a lot of controversy about the way these studies are conducted, and some people disagree with the negative effect that feral cats have upon birds. But I think everyone would agree that they do at least have some negative effect upon birds. So I think as long as people are sterilizing them and feeding them, then it's a good compromise.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan with Ty Moses, who's the editor, the author of a new book, Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. We're also joined by Lila Travis, who's with Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue. We've got a lot of callers on the line, so let's get to some more. Let's go to Janie in Oakland. Hi, Janie. Welcome to Your Call. You there?
Hi.
Hi.
It's actually Jenny. I think you're looking for me. I've been really enjoying my yard this year. I had some scrub jays have babies in my front lemon tree, and I've got to enjoy them. Actually, I think they're still in the neighborhood as a family, possibly going through my backyard. And I do put water out for them, and I have a lot of native plants and also vegetables in the backyard. And we have a lot of fruit trees, so we do have a lot of birds come and visit. The latest visitor has been a baby possum, and I've gotten a lot of mixed opinions on whether or not I should let the baby possum stay. I see him out there at night. He hasn't really bothered the vegetables. I've read that they can be good for the garden, that they're not really ever harmful to pets, but I don't know if with the possum getting bigger if that will be an issue.
And that's another one of the animals that sometimes people are afraid of. So go ahead and talk about the possum.
Yeah, possums are actually very beneficial in the garden. They eat snails and slugs. They are omnivores. They will eat almost anything. They can digest almost anything. And they will get along just fine with other animals as long as you don't have a dog who could definitely present some danger to the possum. Don't you think so, Lila?
Absolutely. And also, opossums are mousers, believe it or not. I know they move very slowly, but when they want to, they can move fast enough to catch mice. So there are a lot of positive reasons why opossums are wonderful garden friends.
They're gentle. Also, they're gentle, shy animals for the most part.
They really are. They get a bad rap because they look like giant rats. but actually they are North America's only marsupial, which means that the babies are non-placental. They mate, and then 13 days later they give birth, and the babies crawl up a hair path and go into their pouch where they attach to a nipple. And at birth, they have about 22 babies, and 22 babies can fit in one teaspoon. That's how small they are. They're really quite amazing and wonderful creatures, and they've discovered a natural antitoxin in their blood that they're synthesizing in hospitals to save people's lives. So there are
lots of reasons to like the right. Opossums, opossums. You said that they look like giant rats. So let's talk about rats, because that's, I think, mm-hmm. another animal that we have all around us in many places, and that we don't necessarily coexist with very happily.
Rats, yes. No one is very fond of our friend the rat, I'm afraid.
Except a man that you profile in this book.
Yes, in Zeburbia, I tell a story. Well, actually, these were not wild rats. They were pet rats that I met when I was walking around Lake Merritt, and I met a man who was giving his five pet rats some fresh air. We had a wonderful afternoon together. I am actually very fond of rats and mice. I think they're fascinating little creatures. They're intelligent. They're incredibly social. And they have really a complex emotional life. And studies of rat intelligence have shown that rats laugh, they tickle each other during play, they experience joy. They're really quite delightful, and people who keep rats as pets absolutely fall in love with them, with the only drawback being that rats have a rather short lifespan and don't live more than a few years. So I'm a big fan of the rat. The other thing about rats and mice in the wild is that they are food for raptors. Hawks and owls prey on rats. That's why you don't need to put out rat or mouse poison. If you have owls or hawks in your neighborhood, they will take care of them quite well. I think a pair of breeding owls can eat about 3,000 rats in a single four-month breeding cycle. So stay away from the poisons and let the hawks do their job.
Yes, I just want to reiterate that a lot of the animals that come into our center come in because of secondary rodent poisoning. It's not just raptors and owls that eat mice and rats. It's also skunks and opossums and coyotes eat lots of mice and rats.
And then they come poisoned to you? That's how?
Yeah. And unfortunately, these poisons that we are producing are extremely effective, and it's extremely difficult to reverse them.
And so you may not want rats in your house, but you don't know that you may actually end up killing a deer or a possum or a...
Well, not a deer, but one of the animals that's going to eat these poisoned rodents. And unfortunately, if you use the poisons to kill the rodents, which then kills the rodents' predators, you're creating an environment that will invite in more rodents. So you're not really solving your problem. You're making it worse. So we really advocate not using any kind of poisons.
Right. I completely agree. And there are a couple of local groups. One of them is called Raptors Are the Solution. You can look up raptorsarethesolution.org. And they are trying to get these anticoagulant poisons banned because they do so much damage in the food web. And they also kill many of our pets, cats and dogs, that pick up these poisoned rodents. So there's really absolutely no good reason to use these products.
That's Ty Moses. She's the author of Zuburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. And Lila Travis is with Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue. Lila, you had something else that you wanted to add?
I just wanted to add that the Hungry Owl Project is also another great organization, and they will actually walk you through how to create and encourage owls, create nest boxes and encourage owls to come to your property to help mm-hmm. you with your rodent population problem.
Right. And we'll put all of these resources at yourcallradio.org. You can also post comments there, tell us about any issues that you're having, or post other organizations for resources like this. Again, that's yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan. This is Your Call, and let's welcome Robert in San Francisco to the show. Hi, Robert.
Hi there. Is it me?
Yeah, it's you.
Great. So I'm wondering what advice you have for someone who is an urban gardener in Bernal Heights with a green thumb, but who cannot outcompete the wildlife that comes through the yard. So I've pretty much given up on vegetable gardening because my entire garden would be consumed, sometimes in just one night.
Yeah, and Ty's no stranger to this quandary.
Yes, I feel for you, Robert. I've been there. So tell me, what are you growing right now?
Mostly tomatoes, but I'm not growing them anymore because after two or three years in a row of not getting any tomatoes out of half a dozen bushes, I gave up.
Well, without knowing really what the layout of your property is, would it be possible to put the tomatoes in pots and move them to the front of the house, on the porch?
The front of the house would be out on this is Bernal Heights, it's very urban, very dense, so front of the house would be out on the sidewalk on the street, which isn't allowed.
That's too bad.
Pots help a little, but whatever it is that's eating them can crawl up the pots, and I don't know if it's, we have everything here, so I don't know if it's raccoons or rats or mice or squirrels. We do have lots of hawks in the neighborhood, but they're not enough to control whatever it is.
Well, it sounds like it's time to embrace the wild.
Uh-huh, and just give up, which is what I've done.
And giving up
is... plant something new, right?
Yes, giving up isn't quite the frame. I would put it in the context of creating something new and wonderful. Native plant gardening can be so gratifying and so beautiful and drought-tolerant and... there are so many amazing, wonderful plant communities that you can plant where you live that will provide all kinds of beautiful, interesting-looking seeds and berries that will be pleasing to the eye and will provide food for animals.
And let's try. Thanks very much for the call, Robert. I want to try and squeeze in a couple more callers before we're done here. Let's go to Lynn in San Francisco. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to your call. You there, Lynn? We have Lynn in San Francisco going once. Let's go to Marga in Oakland. Hi, Marga. Welcome to your call. Are we having phone issues here? I can see that there are callers on the line. Hi, welcome to your call. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Okay. I just wanted to say I have been studying, taking Jane Goodall's method since 98 here by Arroyo Viejo Creek in Oakland. Never had the feral cat take a bird. We've had peaceable kingdom as long as I put a little food out. So they'd rather eat kibble than chase each other. It's been wonderful, and I can't wait to read your book. Hope you're going to put up whether you're going to have book signings. And I also wanted to ask whether you had any trouble getting it published, because I wouldn't think that most urban publishers would understand what you're doing very well.
Well, thank you so much, Marga, and I'm so thrilled to hear about your peaceable kingdom. That really is the ideal that we're all striving for. My book was, I was lucky enough to find a wonderful publisher. Parallax Press in Berkeley actually invited me to write this book because they were interested to have a book about animals and about mindfulness and about mindfully observing the animals that live among us. So they're a wonderful publisher. They publish books by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen Buddhist monk, and they publish other books on mindfulness.
There's a lot of that peppered throughout this book, actually.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
And let me try and squeeze in one more caller. Do we have Lynn in San Francisco? Hi, Lynn. Welcome to your call. Yeah, go ahead.
Is that you?
Yes.
Hi. My question is there a service that will humanely remove a feral family like raccoons from one's home wall and not put it down? I had this situation this spring. I was willing to wait until the mom and the raccoon babies left on their own accord, but something attacked them within the wall, and I assume it was another raccoon because coyotes can't get up the second floor, and anyway, it was quite a mess, and the mom finally was, finally left. But the thing is, when I called one of these humane services, they advertised on the...
Oh, I don't know what happened, but Lynn, Ty is saying she does have some advice for you, so let's
yes,
go ahead.
Yes, Lynn, I suggest that you call Wild Care. This is a group in located in Marin that will send a humane expert out to your home to help humanely remove the raccoons from your house and then show you how to seal them up the house so they can't get back in. Now, there are a number of private organizations or private companies out there that call themselves humane wildlife removal services. But if anyone says they're going to come to your house and trap and kill an animal or poison it or trap and relocate it, this is not someone that you want to be doing business with, because that is not the way to solve the problem.
The benefit of working with the WildCare Wildlife Exclusion Program is that WildCare is a wildlife rehabilitation center. So their main focus is helping wildlife in trouble. And their wildlife exclusion program was created.
Don't worry.
Because they needed to find some funding for their nonprofit work.
And so just in the last 2 minutes that we have here, Ty, when you wrote this book, what are the things you want people to take away from this? And are you trying to challenge kind of some of the customary ways we've had of thinking about urban wildlife?
Yes. You know, I think the thing that's most important to me is that I think part of our humanity must be to become more connected to the other species around us, to the other creatures that share our planet, and extend compassion to them and behave responsibly toward them. You know, I think we all know intellectually that we're not the only species on the planet, but it's quite another thing to really grasp this emotionally and to look around and realize that we're simply one animal on this incredibly, extraordinarily diverse and beautiful planet.
All right. Excuse me. That's Ty Moses, and she is a former senior editor of Alternet, and she's the author of the new book, Zooburbia, Meditations on the Wild Animals Among Us. We've also been joined by Lila Travis, who's with Yggdrasil Urban Wildlife Rescue. Thank you both for spending this hour with us. It's just been a pleasure.
Thank you, Holly. Wonderful to be here.
Thank you so much.
And we'll put links to all of the information and some of the organizations that we mentioned on our website. It's yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can continue to post comments. You can tell us about other organizations that are doing great work with urban wildlife. You can tell us how you've adapted your garden to coexist better with the animals all around us. Again, that's yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. Thanks so much. How is fracking for oil and gas affecting our health? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with scientist and environmental activist Sandra Steingraber. She's science advisor for Americans Against Fracking. An increasing number of studies link hydraulic fracturing to contaminated groundwater and air pollution. What are the effects on public health? And after a push for statewide fracking moratorium in California failed, where does the fight for regulation stand? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.